Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Helmut. We start by recapping a busy week in the Metro News and news from around the region. Joining us from the WFPO newsroom are Gabe Bullard, Devin Katayama, Philip Bailey, and Erica Peterson. Welcome back, everyone.
Hey. Good to be here.
We want to hear from you, of course. Do you have some thoughts about the Louisville Orchestra contract dispute? Perhaps the new rules for food trucks, the city's new emergency alert system, which is up and running today, about redistricting or the firing, or not the firing, the suspension of the parks director and the involvement of the Wave troubleshooter. If you have some thoughts on these or any other stories, we'd like to hear from you. 502-814-TALK, that's 502-814-8255, or toll-free, 1-877-TALK, that's 1-877-814-TALK, I left out the prefix, or 1-877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through our Facebook page. Erica, let's start with you because we have some breaking news this afternoon from Western Kentucky. There's been a mining accident. What's the latest on that?
Well, the mining accident, it involves two blasters, two men who work for a company that was basically setting explosives at this surface mine. And it's at the Equality Surface Mine, which is near Centertown in Ohio County. And it's owned by Armstrong Coal. And what happened basically is the men were on the surface mine, as far as we know, and a high wall collapsed, which is just a very, if you've ever seen a surface mine, they're high walls. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those. It collapsed onto their vehicle and buried it in rubble, which created a problem because authorities had to start removing the rubble in order to get to the men. And that's, as far as we know, what they're in the process of doing right now.
We know anything about the condition of the man?
We know nothing. The state just identified them as 47-year-old Daryl Winstead and 33-year-old Samuel Lindsay. But as far as we know, we don't know their condition. They're still calling it a rescue mission as opposed to a recovery mission, which means that they're holding out some hope that the men are alive under the rubble.
And these men aren't technically miners. They work for the blasting company, right?
They do. And the blasting company is the Mine Equipment and Mill Supply Company, which also goes by MEMSCO. And it's owned by Midland Powder Company, which is in Evansville. And the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration keeps records of violations and such. And they have a number for this company. They've been cited about 50 times in the past 2 years for work at coal mines and quarries. And 21 of those violations were categorized as significant and substantial, which carry a heavier penalty. One of those violations was this past July at the Equality Surface Mine.
Mm. And again, this happened this morning, right?
It did, about 6:45.
Okay, I'm sure there will be a full investigation, and we'll have more details as they become available. I want to turn now to Gabe Bullard and talk about the latest in the saga of the Louisville Orchestra. Gabe, 1 week ago we were here, it was last Friday afternoon, as our fund drive was finishing up. The news trickled mm-hmm. in that there was probably an agreement, looked like there was one, but here we are again, still nothing.
Yeah, it was an odd situation last week. The management had, this dispute is over the size of the orchestra.
Right.
The musicians want 71 players or close to it. The management started wanting fewer players than that, saying that that's all that was financially sustainable. Over time, they had started coming a little closer. The musicians wanted 57 players up to 60. The management said 54 up to 55. The musicians rejected that largely on the claim that the rest of the musicians that would have been more than 55, so that extra 2 to 5 players, were still in town, that about 14 musicians of the 71 had left town for other work, had found jobs elsewhere, retired perhaps, and so they wanted everyone who was still in Louisville to have a job. Last week, the management gave an ultimatum to the musicians. They said, "We will sign anyone who is still in Louisville as long as they agree to, as long as more than 55 people, any number above 55, those people agree to retire or otherwise leave the orchestra by June 2013. So they would have a 55-member orchestra going forward. The musicians, nothing happened. We didn't hear back. They said that the threats that the management might start looking for replacement players were very clear, but they didn't know all the details of the contract. For instance, who would have to retire, what would happen if they didn't retire, if they would just be laid off, and how that would work. So they had requested more information. At about 5:30 or so, maybe closer to 6 o'clock, the management sent out a statement saying the musicians had accepted the contract, they could go back to work. In fact, the musicians simply agreed to this idea of cutting down to 55. They still differ over how many should be signed up on up front, who should be signed on up front, and how long it should take to get to 55, whether or not that should be the length of the contract or that should come up any sooner. So what happened last week was the debate continued. The management then said, if you don't agree to this by Monday, we're done negotiating. If you don't agree to this by Monday, we're going to look for replacement players. They're also offering the musicians right now the chance to leave the group negotiating and sign on individually for their old positions. And they do have first right of refusal until Monday.
So the close of business Monday?
Yeah, end of the day Monday. The management says this is not a bluff. They're very serious about this. They will be willing to start looking for musicians Tuesday morning.
Is there a pool of musicians they can choose from?
Not exactly. The American Federation of Musicians is a very large union, about 90,000 musicians in the U.S. and Canada mostly, and they really are the source for professional musicians, high-quality professional symphonic musicians. It's not clear where the orchestra could go to find these other players. There are non-union professionals. They don't really exist in Louisville in large numbers. There are amateurs who perhaps haven't yet joined the union who could play. It's unlikely anyone who has hopes of joining the union or who is in the union now, though, is going to be willing to play for the orchestra, because the orchestra, like the Kentucky Opera, is on the unfair list of the AFM, which means any union members who cross that line, who play without a contract between the local and the orchestra, will face about $50,000 in fines, other penalties. It could be career-ending, and it would certainly tarnish their name.
And along a parallel track, we have the Kentucky Opera, which has been trying to contract with orchestra musicians for their various performances. Where does that stand?
Well, last week they also issued an ultimatum in saying that they were done negotiating. They rescinded their offer to the musicians for what's called a per-performance contract for these upcoming performances of The Marriage of Figaro. A per-performance contract is essentially what the opera would have, or another company would have, if they wanted to hire a group of AFM musicians. They had sought that for Carmen last month, but the musicians, through negotiating, had been able to gain what was essentially a shorter version of their orchestra contract, with some pay and benefits that they wouldn't get in a per-performance deal. The musicians wanted that again for The Marriage of Figaro, because they said, you gave it to us once, that's what we feel we deserve without an orchestra contract in place. The opera, however, said they couldn't afford it. They wanted something a little more in line with what they were seeking. And last week, the opera rescinded their offer, said they would look for other players. They're also on the unfair list. They're going to have trouble finding anybody to play. They also have the option of using two pianos and a harpsichord instead of a pit orchestra.
And they say they don't want to do that because it doesn't sound very good, right?
Yeah. Universally, most people I've talked to have said you can perform an opera that way, but it's not by any stretch the preferable way to perform an opera. We actually have a clip. Sometimes the Kentucky Opera would come in for our sister station, WUOL, and play lunchtime classics. And they would play certain songs arranged for piano with opera. And we have a clip of that we can listen to. And, you know, this is arranged for a single piano, single singer, but the union has been the loudest out-of-town union members in saying that, in pointing out that this really, if you're asking people to pay the full opera tickets for this, isn't going to be that preferable. I talked with David Roth. He's the director of the opera before, when he first floated this idea that they could use pianos and a harpsichord, and he said it's not preferable. It's not what they want. They would rather have a pit orchestra, but the show has to go on. They are dedicated to giving the best performances they can. If that means they're going to have to do a few shows with pianos, they're going to do it and do it as best as they can.
So are they kind of waiting to see what happens on by Monday?
It's not yet clear. I've been trying to get a definite answer on that, on if the orchestra signs these new players wherever they come from, on if that would mean that the opera would have that source of musicians. It is unlikely, by any information I can ascertain, that it's unlikely they would be able to seat and field an orchestra by that point to play these performances of The Marriage of Figaro. It's also not clear whether or not a new orchestra contract, if one were signed, would even affect the opera at this point, because the previous proposals were not set to start until January.
All right. Thank you, Gabe. We'll be watching to see what happens. Let's turn to Devin Katayama, who covered the arrival or the visit by the head of Ford, or the North American division of Ford, to Louisville. Big announcement regarding investment in the two Louisville plants, Devin, and a lot of jobs on the way.
Yeah, and so the Mark Fields was the president of the Americas. The appearance was more of a congratulatory appearance, and also the assurance that the investment in the Louisville area is happening. And he also wanted to take the opportunity to show that they are keeping jobs in America.
And he's on the way.
As many of you know, at Ford, we reconfirmed our commitment to U.S. manufacturing, and it's a commitment to strengthening American manufacturing well into the future. This is not just an announcement about a next-generation product here in Louisville. We're talking about a long-term commitment. As you said, $1.2 billion is a lot of money, and you know, we're going to be here for quite some time with a great workforce.
And they really, all the Governor Steve Beshear and Mayor Greg Fisher, they are all here. They really wanted to let everyone know that this is a huge investment for the Louisville area. They even took the opportunity to thank Mayor, former Mayor Abramson, and his involvement with getting Ford investments here. But what this also gave was kind of a timeline for when hiring is going to be expected. And, you know, we have about 3,100 jobs that are being part of this four-year contract that was recently ratified. So they let us know exactly, or not exactly, but when these jobs are going to be hired. So we're looking at, for the truck plant, jobs are going to be hired by summer is what they're expecting. For the assembly plant, they're expecting to start the hiring next year. And that hiring process will depend greatly on the demand for the Ford Escape SUV that will be coming out.
Now, they're going to be making some new vehicles. I know at the Louisville Assembly Plant, or at least one, have they announced what that is yet?
They haven't announced what that is. They're in the pre-production for that, so that's expected later this year, I believe. And we are, I think everybody's kind of curious about what those new, you know, things are going to be.
Mm-hmm. And they've retooled the plant. So they can kind of mix and match them, mix it up a little bit.
Right.
All right. Thank you, Devin. Let's turn to Philip M. Bailey. Philip, a lot of talk this week around town about the suspension of Louisville's Metro Parks Director, Mike Heitz. He was on a TV report where he was drinking at a local establishment, and his city-owned vehicle was parked outside, and he had apparently been driving it was getting ready to get in it when he was approached by the TV crew. What happened this week?
Well, essentially, I guess what we saw on Wave 3, Wave troubleshooter Eric Flack confronted Metro Parks Director Mike Heitz after about a week-long investigation of secretly videotaping him, undercover videotaping him at KT's, where he was drinking and driving his city-issued vehicle. Mayor Fisher obviously suspended Mr. Heitz for 30 days. Subsequent reports have come out saying that Mr. Heitz was found guilty of a DUI back in 2009. He had a previous DUI before he even worked for the city back in 1977. The question that has come up, interestingly enough, is there are two conversations. Number one, the conversation about Heitz, should he have had a city vehicle, Mayor Fisher's actions, and what were Mayor Abramson's actions before that, but also the question of journalistic ethics of how Wave 3 handled the case, handled the story. If you go to Wave 3's website, a lot of times you have a lot of commenters giving as much criticism to Eric Flack and Wave 3 for the ethics of the story, meaning that should he have allowed, witnessed Mr. Heitz drinking and then later driving, what was it as far as the ethics of ambushing him, what some people call an ambush, confronting him after he got out in the bar. So this story has implications not only politically and in city government as far as Heitz's suspension, but also ethically as far as journalism is concerned in that debate.
It's also interesting if you follow the coverage of this, how news outlets, especially other TV stations, competitors with Wave 3, had gone about mentioning the story. It's a story that they had to cover. Wave 3's involvement is something that they had to cover, but we didn't always see news outlets saying Wave 3 uncovered this.
And this had happened before. Rick, you probably remember this as well. There was a story a few years back in which one television station had discovered some documents that weren't properly shredded by Louisville police. And when other stations, and it was found actually nearby a dumpster of one of the news stations, and when other stations had reported on it, they refused, it seemed like, to even want to mention the other stations. In fact, the only time I can remember a television station mentioning another one is during the controversy over the coverage of the Thunder over Louisville, where who was going to broadcast Thunder or not. So you're right. I think Abe is right. There's a sort of unspoken rule amongst television media in particular, but sometimes it bleeds over even into print media, where you don't mention another outlet, regardless of even if they clearly are a part of the story, not only if they just broke it, but they are a part of it.
It's a highly competitive.
It's a competitive world out there.
We do have an email from Adam, who says, well, I'm just going to paraphrase. He says, this was gotcha journalism, if it can be called journalism at all. But apparently, maybe we should invite Eric to be on the program to talk about it. But I heard him on another radio program on WHAS, I'll give him credit, where he said he had gotten several tips or complaints from somebody about the parks director driving his city-owned vehicle and drinking at this establishment, and responded, you know, to that. So,
yeah, and what came out of it that was interesting was the fact that, you know, as a result of that story, whether people want to call it, you know, tabloid journalism, ambush journalism or not, it did force people to look at further into Heitz's background and his record, and it showed that while he did receive a DUI and pled guilty to it back in 2009, it was not in his personnel file. I believe Wave 3 did get a chance to talk to former Mayor Jerry Abramson about that in a statement that he released, saying essentially that he had talked to Heitz about it, and that he had taken away his car privileges at that time and had asked him or told him to get into an alcohol treatment program. There still are some lingering questions, though, about why that was never mentioned in his personnel file and how someone who had a DUI previously and pled guilty with one was still allowed to drive a city-issued vehicle.
Is the city policy clear? Can you go out to dinner in your take-home vehicle and have a glass of wine or two? Or does it say specifically you can do that?
Metro government policy is pretty clear in that if you drink, you can't drive your city-issued vehicle. Why this exemption was made or why the situation happened as it did, and this is why I think people may not like the methodology in which Wave 3 went about it. The story, though, is still pertinent, and the questions are still pertinent as to why was there a break of communication from one administration to the next, and did the Fisher administration even know that Mr. Heitz had a DUI in the first place?
And all right. We'll post the city vehicle guidelines after the show. We'll post those up in the notes online so anyone can go and look at them. Yeah, you have to follow the rules of the road. There are we've done a few stories on this already that police officers, department heads who do have their vehicles can use them for personal use, though.
And if you haven't been following, I'm sure Wave 3 has the series of stories they've been running now on their website as well. All right, let's change the subject now. Get back to you, Gabe. Let's see if there's an update on the hospital merger. Anything new this week? There was the forums last week. Anything going on now?
Yeah, some follow-up and some more questions on that. Last week, the Board of Health had said the Board of Health had a forum that invited the partners from University of Louisville Hospital or University Medical Center, Jewish Hospital, St. Mary's Healthcare, and also Catholic Health Initiatives. The big concern with this merger is that Catholic care doctrines might control care at University Hospital. A safety net hospital, a hospital of last resort for a lot of folks as well. And so there were just a lot of questions in general. This Board of Health forum was meant to address those questions and make sure that equity and access were not going to be hurt. The principal showed up. They answered questions. They had answered some questions beforehand, and those answers had been posted on the Board of Health website. The Board of Health said they're going to keep sending questions to the merging partners. A spokesman for University Medical Center said they will gladly answer those questions, but a lot of the questions overlap, so they're filtering through those, deciding how to address all those topics. The African-American Think Tank also held a forum, more of a community forum, on the topic last week, and they are they're still gathering questions. They're going to have some meetings and gather community concerns. The concern with the think tank, they say that this information has not been properly disseminated by the merging partners, that there are people who don't follow the news that closely, who don't subscribe to the newspaper, who don't go to the Board of Health website to see this, and they say the merging partners should be more open about this contract. There is a group of people led by Hani Goldman, a local PR professional who is involved in this. She says out of her own interest, it's not a professional gig for her. She says she is also pushing out questions, hoping that the merging partners will address them. Her questions tend to concern the management structure of the hospital and also this contract that will control what happens with certain procedures and what's the basis for the contract and what are the details in the contract. The Jefferson County Attorney's Office is also seeking a copy of this contract, which the partners say is in progress.
All right. Thank you, Gabe. Let's go back over to Erica Peterson. Erica, the big launch this week of the city's emergency notification system.
Yeah, it's supposed to be functional today, actually.
So what prompted this? This was a situation in Rubbertown that prompted getting this new system, right?
Yeah, in March there was an explosion at a plant in Rubbertown, and it killed two workers, and it turns out didn't pose any immediate danger to a lot of the neighborhood, but there was a lot of confusion. Some residents were told to shelter in place, some were told to evacuate, and nobody really knew what was going on. And the system the city has had up until now is called RCall, which is just for Rubbertown. And it's basically a hotline that you can call and it'll tell you a recorded message saying, you know, there's this problem going on right now or there's nothing going on. And so that kind of, you know, that kind of system requires somebody to reach out to it. It requires them to think something's going on and call our call. And so the city decided to implement basically an emergency alert system for the entire city that will actually notify people if there are emergencies in their area.
What happens when you get, well, first of all, how do you get signed up for it?
Well, you can go to the city's website, which I believe is louisvilleky.gov. You can sign up there. You can, if you don't have internet, you can call MetroCall at 311, or you can go to any library branch.
And what happens if there's an emergency? How do you get notified?
Well, you can choose how you want to be notified. Right. Some people want to be notified via text message, some phone call, some email. And so you can choose how you want to be notified. And my phone actually rang earlier this week because I had signed up and there was a test. And the phone rang and there was a recorded message basically saying you signed up for this alert system and here's what this means. But the kind of alerts you can sign up for like emergencies in your area, and it's neighborhood specific. You put your address on there and it will tell you literally, you know, your block, your neighborhood when there are mm-hmm. problems. Or emergency weather situations. So if a tornado is heading towards Louisville again, you might get a call saying there's a tornado in your area. Stay inside or whatever is going on.
So this is really expanded from what they had before.
Yes, very much so.
And was this pricey? How much did it cost?
The contract is for $150,000 for 3 years, so $150,000 a year. And that is less money than they had originally budgeted for it. So I guess they'll renegotiate the contract in 3 years, and it could end up being more expensive or less expensive.
All right. Thank you, Erica. Devin Katayama, I want to go back to you and talk about redistricting. The Metro Council approved a redistricting plan last night. Doesn't seem like much hand-wringing this time.
No, not at all. It was a refreshing moment in politics in general. In fact, Kevin Cramer was saying how this should be a model for the entire nation. I kind of felt like I was at a University of Louisville Board of Trustees meeting where they were just praising Mr. Ramsey. But everybody had something good to say for the most part. It was a bipartisan effort, a lot of support from the beginning. They finished in plenty of time. Any changes need to be done by the end of the year. So the ordinance is complete. It was voted on unanimously by 25 of the present members. Councilman Tom Owen had an excused absence. So now it heads to Mayor Fisher's office. I haven't heard yet if he's signed it, but he has a decision to sign it, requests changes, veto. If he does nothing, by the time the next full council meeting comes along, it just becomes enacted. It becomes law. And the maps will be taking effect immediately.
So there are still 26 council districts?
26 council districts. Now there's six majority-minority is what they're calling them, districts, which means basically 50% or more African-Americans in districts 1 through 6. Previously, it was 1 through 5. This time around, they added a sixth district.
And so really no districts really greatly affected by it, but there are some
adjustments. Yeah, I mean, Kevin Cramer's district, apparently, according to Steve Hagg, had the biggest adjustments made. I mean, at the beginning, I think around map 10, which I think they went to almost 14, but they call them 10D, he was saying he lost around 50% of his people who would have previously been able to vote for him in the beginning. But again, he thought that the process went along smoothly. The only concerns at the beginning of the process and throughout the process was certain drops in African-American populations in districts 1 through 5. But the district which has the least amount, I believe it's Shanklin's district with just over 50%, around 52%, she was saying it really doesn't matter. As long as there's over 50% representation, it's fair. And she was saying, you know, if for example, if you got a Kroger was drawn out of your district, it doesn't matter. That Kroger is still going to be there. You know, and the people that are going to be working for you, she was saying, are still going to work for you. You're just going to have to work with somebody else differently.
All right, Devin, thanks to you, and thanks to the rest of our WFPL news team, Philip Bailey, Gabe Buller, Devin Katayama, and Erica Peterson. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for being here.
Coming back, actually, Philip's going to stick around, and we're going to be joined by Kenny Colston and talk about Kentucky politics and the election coming up in November. And we again welcome your input at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255, or toll-free 877-814-TALK. That's 1-877-814-TALK. Back in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. We now turn to Kentucky politics. State's general election just over a week away, and join us to talk about it are Kenny Colston, who covers politics for CN2. Kenny's on the phone with us. Kenny, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. And also WFPL political editor Philip Bailey is here. And again, we want to hear from you, 502-814-TALK, if you have some thoughts on the election, 502-814-8255, or toll-free 877-814-8255. Well, here we are about 10 days out from the election. There seems to be a little excitement, I guess you'd say, at this time. Let's start with the governor's race. Democrat Steve Beshear, Republican David Williams, Independent Gatewood Galbraith. And Kenny, some are predicting a blowout of historic proportions at this point.
Yeah, it's really not looking good for the Republican side in this race. David Williams has not made up a lot of ground. We had a CN2 poll last week where he's still at 28. He's down 28% to Governor Steve Beshear. That's maybe a three-point difference compared to the Survey USA poll that the Courier Journal and WHAS 11 has. But when you include margins of error, we're really not that different. So it's not looking very good. People used to joke that, you know, David Williams was looking at a Pepe Martin-type finish, but I don't think that's a joke anymore.
Pepe Martin, of course, the Republican that ran against was Paul Patton back when, and kind of ran a token campaign, and Paul Patton, of course, a big victor in that race. So, Philip, David Williams, is there going to be any last-second push to cut this lead and maybe have a chance to win?
Well, I think what you'll see is, you know, Senator Williams will run some last ads here in the last 10 days here, attacking not only Governor Beshear, but you've also seen some ads already going after his running mate, former Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson. The question is, and I think when you say historic, I mean, I think there was a Smart Politics recently came out with its own analysis saying that this could be the worst election for Republicans since 1870. So I don't really know at the end of the day what David Williams can do. Essentially, his race was really cut at the knees ever since the Republican primary when, you know, Phil Moffitt had a much better performance than anticipated. You still never saw the Tea Party get behind Senator Williams, and even the establishment Republicans really didn't rally around him. So I don't know if there is really any hope as far as what his ads can do. There is speculation that the gap will close the closer we get to Election Day, so it might not be 30 points. It might be, and this is not meant to be facetious at all, it might be a respectable 20-point blowout. But at this point, the questions are starting to turn to, how badly will Senator Williams' loss affect down-ticket Republicans? And also, a lot of the conversation that's happening now is, will this affect his ability to lead the Senate after the election?
Yeah, that was my next question, assuming, and we always say, you know, the only poll that matters is the one taken on the, you know, second Tuesday in November, but assuming that there is a landslide victory for Governor Beshear, what would this mean for Williams' leadership position in the Senate?
I mean, it could mean that essentially he could be, anyone who wants to challenge him would have certainly a better chance. At the end of the day, you're right, Rick, though. At the end of the day, the only poll that matters is the one on November 8th. Senator Williams is either looking at a historic blowout or a historic comeback, which he can sort of point to everyone and say, look, I told you so.
Kenny, have you had a chance to talk to Senator Williams recently?
Yes, I have. I actually caught up with him yesterday. He spoke to the Kentucky Association of Counties, KACO. He kind of made his familiar campaign pitch there about pension reform, tax code reform. Like Philip said, Williams thinks that he's going to close this gap in the last 10 days. He thinks he's very close. We've not seen any internal polling that says that from the Williams campaign, but he believes that. And, you know, races always close because when you have polls, you have the undecideds, which, you know, are hovering around 10 to 12%, and there's no undecideds on Election Day. You know, the numbers add up completely to 100. So it's conceivable, like Philip said, that it is a 20-point loss rather than, you know, like a 30-point loss. But Williams is doing what any challenger would do at this point, whether they're down 2 or whether they're down 20. He's saying, I have a chance. Don't give up on me yet. He was campaigning yesterday with Senator Rand Paul in Bowling Green. He's still trying to fight on this bus tour in the last 10 to 12 days.
All right. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. We're talking to Kenny Colston from CN2 and WFPL's Philip Bailey about the Kentucky governor's race and other races, which we'll turn to now. Let's turn to the race for attorney general. Philip, former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani in town here in Louisville campaigning for Todd Peeple, the Republican nominee.
Yes, for Republicans, the attorney general's race probably is the silver lining in all of this. Todd Peeple has come out as probably one of the more polished candidates, certainly someone who, win or lose in the situation, has a bright future probably in state politics. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani was obviously in Louisville earlier this week, stumping for Peeple, another big-name Republican for him. And I'm not sure people in these parts are used to the way Giuliani campaigns, but he didn't mince words. He tried to connect Attorney General Jack Conway to President Obama and made several pitches on both energy policy and the president's health care law.
Come on, get rid of this guy. Elect an attorney general that's going to go to court the first day he's there and join those brave attorneys general that are saying enough of Obamacare. It's unconstitutional. You can't mandate me to have health care. You can't mandate me to have to buy something. If you can mandate me to have to buy health care, where is it going to stop? Where are you going to stop mandating me? Tell me what the line is that you're going to stop telling me what to do at the federal level. Well, there is no line.
And what you hear there is, you know, Giuliani essentially picking up what people have said the entire campaign, trying to nationalize the race, that the president's health care law, which is derisively called Obamacare by Republicans, it has the individual mandate is too overbearing. Mr. Peeple has made continuous claims that Jack Conway has failed to check that law, did not join in that lawsuit by other attorneys general across the country against the president's health care law. I had a chance to talk to Mayor Giuliani after his stump speech and asked him, or at least reminded him, that the individual mandate was a Republican idea, at least in the mid-1990s, one that was advocated by a former presidential candidate, Bob Dole. Mayor Giuliani made it pretty blunt. That was a dumb idea then. It's a dumb idea now, regardless if it was Democrats or Republicans. So you see, I think, a big-name Republican like Giuliani, a former presidential candidate himself, coming here, showing you that people does have, in a lot of ways, more attention in this race than the top of the ticket. And that was something that, you know, Mayor Giuliani didn't really want to address the governor's race at all. But certainly Mr. Peeple's challenge to Attorney General Jack Conway is gaining a lot of attention in Republican circles.
Kenny, has CN2 done any polling in this race?
Yeah, we've, we have Attorney General Jack Conway up pretty big as well. He's almost right there with the governor. Now, according to Todd Peeple, he has a poll that shows him within striking distance. So to be fair to him, you know, I want to say that's what he says his campaign is showing. But our poll showed that it was about, it was in that high 20s again. But, you know, Republicans, Phillips is right, Republicans are looking at Todd Peeple as maybe a consolation prize if Williams is not going to win, which is what we're, you know, looking at right now. And I caught up with Attorney General Jack Conway, Peeple's opponent, yesterday. And he said he's really not worried about all these national figures like Mike Huckabee and really Giuliani that people has brought in. Conway said that this is a state race, not a federal race, which is what he said every time in kind of response to something people does, and that he's not bringing in national figures because it's not a national race.
Just a couple of minutes left, Kenny. The other races we haven't talked about yet, Secretary of State, Treasurer, Agriculture Secretary, and Auditor. Are any of these close?
Yeah, I mean, polling shows that they're not. Our poll shows that they're not. But, you know, of course, Republican Agriculture Commissioner Jamie Comer, he's up on TV airwaves now. A lot of people seem to think that he has a shot to close the gap in the last 2 weeks because it's a down-ballot race, and people may not be as plugged in as they may have been in the governor's race or something else. So Jamie Comer could beat Bob Farmer there on November 8th. Casey Crosby actually has like a 2-to-1 fundraising advantage over current treasurer Todd Hollenbach. So she's a Republican that could be kind of sneaky. She's not on TV yet, but you have to think that's coming any day now. It looks like Allison Grimes and Adam Edelin in the Secretary of State and Auditor's races, they look like they're pulling away from their opponents. But there could be some Republican pickups in the very down-ballot races. But then again, a lot of Democrats are going around and saying it's going to be a clean sweep.
And, Philip, the current Secretary of State was out with some turnout predictions this week looks like it's going to be pretty low.
Yeah, Secretary of State Elaine Walker predicts about 25% to 28% turnout for this election. One isn't really sure who that would help. I think Kenny makes a good point here that at the end of the day, if Republicans get two of these seven races, they would be happy. The only race in which you consistently hear that Republicans are confident that they will win is the agriculture commissioner race. Other than that, it's either dead even to their mind or not looking so good. So, you know, we'll wait for election day to tell us what really happens. But I think at this election, more so than any others, has put us on notice that, you know, the top of the ticket really does matter. I'm not sure if the Democrats want to go around saying that it's a clean sweep yet, because that could in many ways backfire on them, particularly on down-ticket candidates, because it could give them the sense that, well, if this race is already in the bag, if Governor Beshear is winning by 30 points, why do I really need to show up? So both sides have to get the base out, regardless of what the polls say, and how that affects down-ticket races, we all have to really watch and see.
All right. Thanks to Kenny Colston from CN2 for joining us today. Kenny, we'll hope to have you back soon.
Yeah, I would love to do it again.
All right. Thanks, Kenny. And thanks again to WFPL's political editor, Philip M. Bailey, talking about the state races coming up in the Kentucky elections on November 8th. We're going to turn our attention now to some changes announced recently regarding food trucks in the city. And here, Philip's going to stick around and talk about that. He's earning his money today. And also joining us to talk about that as we get him in the door is Joe Sanka from Leo Weekly. First of all, Philip, what exactly does the city have a specific definition of what constitutes a food truck?
Well, at this point, when initially the original peddler's ordinance did not have any space carved out for mobile food trucks, as they proliferated, become more popular, that was really what the Fisher administration wanted to get at here, was defining what these businesses are, what they do, and how they should or should not operate. The issue really appears to be just a breakdown of communication.
So what are some of the major changes, Joe, that the city has announced regarding food trucks?
Well, the regulations that they kind of eased up on and wanted to cut the red tape for were lowering the buffer zone that a food truck, the distance that had to be from either a residential neighborhood or a brick-and-mortar establishment that sells a similar product. And the other thing that cut down on red tape was instead of having to have a permit for every single location that the food truck stopped at, they would just need one permit per vehicle per year. So cutting a bunch of red tape there that they didn't have to jump through hoops for every spot.
Now, this has prompted some complaints from a couple of proprietors, right?
Yeah, they have a problem with three things. First of all food truck vendors now have to obtain a criminal background check for every employee that they have in the truck. Secondly, they have to provide a detailed map for every location that they stop at throughout the year. And thirdly, they have to obtain the notarized consent of the property owner where they are operating. And a lot of times that property owner doesn't even live in the state. So that creates a lot of hoops for them to jump through. And those are actually rules that were already on the books, but a lot of people didn't know about them, and the city didn't even bother enforcing them. So now people are aware of this, and the city is saying that eventually this is something that people are going to have to abide by. But for the time being, it's kind of an amnesty period where they aren't going to strictly enforce this and shut down food trucks over the next couple of months.
Well, if we have any ballpark figure as to how many food trucks there are operating in the city?
Oh, wow. I've counted as many as almost a dozen. It depends on the level of sophistication. Some obviously have their trucks painted. I mean, they're real businessmen out here on the go. Others are sort of just starting up right now. I think Joe made a good point, though, about those laws or parts of the regulations that they were complaining about were ones that were already on the books. But because things were so divided, meaning that you had to go to IPL, the health department, the parks department if you happen to be parking in a park, a lot of these rules weren't really in one central location. The Fisher administration put that on there. What's surprising when I mentioned the issue about communication was that, the Fisher administration, Brandon Cohen specifically, who's the analyst who drew up the ordinance, met with a lot of these food truck owners beforehand and had a lot of meetings with them. Yet still, when they announced that this was going to be cutting the red tape, there were a number of food truck drivers and food truck business owners who were still upset about it. So there was a breakdown in communication where it wasn't maybe properly explained to them. Or maybe it wasn't in good enough communication between the mayor's office and those food truck owners where they complained about, well, this doesn't seem to jive with what you were saying as far as cutting the red tape. As a result, I think you see the mayor's office in a bit of damage control where they're trying to really go to the media now and go to the members of the public and to food truck owners and say, no, this is not what we intended. This is already on the books, and that there are more reviews and more revisions that we can make to help these businesses further.
We have a comment from on Facebook from Dean. Why are food truck operators and employees being required to get criminal background checks and other approvals that are not required of a traditional restaurant staff? Do you want to tackle that?
Sure. I guess, and Joe, feel free to chime in. I think the part of that, what Brandon Cohen at least points out, is that the person who is applying for the vendor's license is the one who has to get the background check. It's not really clear, and I could be wrong about this, if every employee actually has to get one, it's the person who has to get the vendor's license.
Yeah, that was one big issue that Matt Davis had, the owner of the Little Cheesers. It's that the government does not force every restaurant owner to have a criminal background check on every employee, but that's what's now going to be required of food truck owners. And he's saying that, why should the government have to approve of every employee that I hire?
And I'm just speculating here, but the thought would be, I would think that the food trucks go out into neighborhoods where there are children and stuff, much like ice cream trucks do, and they're worried about the safety, you know, of young people, I assume. But, you know, restaurants are free to perform background checks as well, and I'm sure many of them do.
I think that's the issue, is that whether the background checks are valid or not, but whether the government should mandate them. I think that that's the point where, because oftentimes, and you saw this during Derby Cruising, where vendors would set up shop, mm-hmm. and the business that had been there for years, that had its brick-and-mortar establishment, didn't like the fact that someone was selling CDs for $8 when my business is selling them for $12, and you can move from place to place. So there is a bit of argument about the competitive edge that food trucks have. I think the Fisher administration certainly entered into this conversation with good intentions, but as I said earlier, there was obviously a breakdown when the Fisher administration says, well, this is cutting red tape, and just about every other business owner or food truck owner says, well, no, it's not cutting red tape. I actually have to cancel some of my shows or cancel some of my appearances. That's not congruent.
Yeah, actually, James Peaton, that was one thing that he mentioned when he first saw the new ordinance. He thought that there was a lot of red tape there for truck owners, and he actually held it and waited for another meeting so those food truck owners could come in and voice their concerns. But they didn't show up at that meeting, and since Mr. Brandon Cohen had been already meeting with those food truck owners, he felt that everyone was on board, and everyone found out after it was announced by the Fisher administration that there were major issues that they had with it.
Food trucks seem to have grown in popularity quite a bit in recent years.
Yeah, they certainly have. They've really exploded all over the country. From Austin, Texas, has hundreds and hundreds of food trucks. You see it all throughout the West Coast. You see it in New York. Oddly enough, you see cities like Chicago, where it's actually still illegal to cook food on a food truck. So that's one of the cities that's having a very heated battle. Okay. And it's really a new thing that cities are trying to work their way through on how to regulate this new industry. And obviously, we're seeing some confusion here in Louisville and how difficult that can be.
Philip, they're using social media to get their customers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one thing that you got to give these food truck owners credit for is that they are very active as far as their business model, whether it's via social networking or traditional media, in fact. And part of this, you know, and the reason why I think this issue hits home and at the heart of Mayor Fisher's administration, remember, he ran on that platform of jobs, jobs, jobs. So you see a situation where you have these sort of entrepreneurs out of nowhere and creating jobs, having a situation where out of their own ingenuity and creativity, coming up with this business model and really asking the city to get out of the way, and the city trying to meet them halfway in this compromise. There's still some work to be done. And I think what you'll see is the council and the mayor's office look at some of these other provisions in the law and see what other regulations they can maybe take out, add in, and change over. But the communication between food truck owners and the mayor's office obviously has to improve if that situation is going to move forward.
All right, WFPL's Philip Bailey and Joe Sanka from Leo Weekly, thanks for joining us to talk about food truck regulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, Laura Unger from the Courier-Journal will join us to talk about her recent article about the pill pipeline from Florida to Kentucky. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Law enforcement and other officials estimate that 60% of the illicit pills that feed addiction in Kentucky come from Florida. Sunshine State has become a pipeline for Kentuckians who feed their addictions to OxyContin, Xanax, and other medications. That's just one of the facts contained in an investigative report published in the Courier-Journal this month on the pain pill pipeline from Florida to Kentucky. And here to talk about it is Laura Unger, who wrote the piece. Welcome back, Laura.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you back on the program. And we welcome your input on this topic as well, 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. or toll free 1-877-814-8255. Well, Laura, the abuse of OxyContin and other pain medications has been epidemic in Kentucky, especially eastern Kentucky, for years. How did this Florida connection develop?
Really, it started with, from what law enforcement in Florida told me, a lot of kind of entrepreneurial folks who started pain clinics. And Broward County became the center. That's in the southern portion of Florida. Mm-hmm. They would advertise on the internet, spread through word of mouth. They had a lot of Kentuckians finding out about them on the internet or through other addicts and then making the trips down. So it just grew from there. Once a few places really started thriving, other places popped up. And in Broward County, they went from about four pain clinics in 2007 to about 100 today. And the sheriff actually said that's more than McDonald's, the McDonald's they have in Broward County.
And so there are hundreds more throughout the state.
Yeah, the total registered number is 736, but some don't have to be registered if they're owned by a certain type of doctor, so that doesn't count all of them.
So what typically happens? So you go into the clinic and say you have a backache or some other problem and just go from there?
Yeah, it was actually pretty shocking talking to a lot of recovering addicts and current addicts about the ease with which they got prescriptions. I mean, people would come in with old MRIs or try to pass off somebody else's MRI as their own, or just say, this one woman said, I fell off a horse, told the guy I fell off a horse, and she walked out with 240 oxycodone pills.
So how does this work? The people that own these clinics, do they also own a pharmacy, or they get some sort of kickback from a pharmacy?
That is the case in some instances. There are people who own both. This one guy, he is after he served time for selling illegal drugs, he got into the pain clinic business. He owned a pharmacy as well as several pain clinics. So that's sometimes the case. Sometimes it's an association with someone who is providing some kind of kickback or something, or it could be a relative, a wife or a husband or something like that as well.
Is there any limit on how many pills they can prescribe? Because some people are walking out with hundreds of these pills, right?
The average, according to law enforcement there, was really high. It is something like 240 pills, oxycodone pills. I can't remember the exact number of Xanax bars, but it was high. I mean, this is folks who don't have real pain. So, you know, you're talking about young people who not in pain with these lies, really, yeah, and walking out with a lot of medicine.
Well, people here in Governor Beshear and others here in Kentucky have called on Florida officials to take some action. What have they done?
They have taken a lot of, Florida in the last couple of years has tried to attack the problem. There are many folks who I talked to who said it came far too late, and the problem is it really, still out of control. But they have passed laws in the last couple of years to crack down. For example, one of the laws, under one of the laws, felons could not own pain clinics. There's laws for registration of most pain clinics, really laws meant to crack down. Of course, there's always folks who find loopholes in the laws, and that's a real concern among folks here and there who are still trying to, shut some of these rogue places down.
Now, you also focused on the terrible human toll of this, of these addictions. And I think on the print version of the paper, you had this photo of a woman shooting OxyContin into her veins, a young woman named Bree, I think.
Yeah.
How did you encounter her?
Well, her mom is actually involved in a group called Stop Now, which is Stop the Organized Pill Pushers Now. And right now, besides kind of protesting outside some of these rogue pain clinics, her life basically revolves around keeping her daughter alive. Her daughter's life went from, good student, making A's and B's, cheerleader, to that all she thinks about is pills all day long, shooting up, and her life. She doesn't care if she dies. She told me, at least I wouldn't feel it. It was so sad, and to see the picture of her. Just how she looks, even the picture of her beforehand, bright eyed young woman. Looking everything going for her. to, you know, someone who just hollow eyes, you know, hollow life. I mean, it's very, very sad situation.
OxyContin, very powerful painkiller. Are pharmaceutical companies getting involved in this at all and trying to make it where it'd be less palatable for abusers?
Yes, there are some companies that are trying to do that. With OxyContin, for example, they're changing, or they have changed the formulation to make it harder to crush and snort and liquefy and shoot up. So there are some other companies going that route as well. But not everybody has, so there are still plenty of brands out there. Roxycodone, for example, the addicts are still managing to snort and shoot up and abuse in that way.
All right, Laura Unger, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Laura Unger with the Courier-Journal. We are out of time for today's program. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For more information about the topics discussed on today's program, visit our website, WFPL.org. I'm Rick Hallett. Have a good weekend.